Gene and I went back to New Jersey that winter of the end of 63, and had a month of home leave. We stayed at our lake place, which by then my family had renovated to be an all year round home. So we went through a hard winter there, and then off we went to Spain. I went out first, as Gene had the two babies, 1 year old and 2 year old. She stayed home with her family, and I went out and found a house and got introduced to all the problems and the staff. And my first meeting with Admiral Polonius was very interesting. Talk about learning management as you go. Mm-hmm. Francisco Cano was the lieutenant who worked for me at the station, totally fluent in English, and he prepared me about what the problems were, and we discussed how I could solve them. My Spanish at that time was not very impressive. I could get along in the present tense with simple sentences, and that was about it. So we went up to the Admiral's office, and the Admiral was in his 60s, a very distinguished gentleman with his uniform and Lord knows how many medals and all kinds of stuff on. I was awed. And we started the conversation. He spoke as much English as I spoke Spanish, so this was not going to go far. So Francisco, who we call Paco, was interpreter. I went back and forth. And the Admiral proceeded into a long speech, very serious. And I'm listening. I really didn't know what he was saying.
Yeah.
So, but I'm thinking, and while he's talking, Francisco is answering and pointing to me, and I'm kind of swelling up, thinking, oh, what a great build-up he's giving me, and I was sent specially by the Smithsonian for all these problems, and I'm wonderful, and I will solve them all. And so the Admiral finally stopped. So I turned to Pac. I said, what? He said he wants to know why the Smithsonian would send anyone as young as you to represent the Smithsonian Institution. That was it.
That's marvelous.
And he was mad. He was insulted. So, I don't know. We kept talking, and we got out of there. I think I made a graceful exit. But the problem turned out that the Admiral, of course, had superiors. The former manager never gave him any information about what we were doing. And it was as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
So I started putting together a monthly report of every damn thing we did at the observatory. And Paco would translate it. He'd bring it up. And two or three of these, I was summoned again for a meeting. I walked in the office. The Admiral got up, came over to me, hugged me, kissed me on both cheeks.
Aww.
I was his great friend.
Aww.
That's all he wanted.
Right.
That's all he wanted.
Well, how wonderful.
Yeah. So I was an immediate enemy. I sent, of course, a version of all this back to headquarters in Cambridge, blowing out of all proportion my brilliance, and got great letter accolades back of what a wonderful problem solver I was. But it was another interesting thing, and we're talking management here, is that the staff I had in Curacao, mm-hmm. and I guess it's fortuitous, maybe it was because Ron was the manager for a year, they were highly trained, they were nice people, the wives were nice people,
mm-hmm.
the things went well, I mean,
mm-hmm.
without a whole lot of effort. I had one or two crises as my acting manager. I had to fire the son of the American consul who kind of put us in a position to hire him, and I had to fire him, and it put me in a real dilemma. And that was one of the telephone calls I received from Cambridge. But the Spain staff were a different cup of tea.
Interesting.
And so I brought into effect, and the station wasn't doing too well in terms of its efficiency observations. So I was going to turn...
Okay, continue. Let me just put it right back on.
So I had a different group of people. One wife was real trouble. The observers themselves were very talented people, probably more talented than the Curacao people in terms of technical skills.
Mm-hmm.
I brought with me a lot of management devices I had used in Curacao to make sure there were instructions posted from the time someone got in the evening and sunset till left in the morning about everything that had to be done at the station before people could go home. People at Curacao thought I was a genius for doing this because we never slipped up. The procedures got published in the newsletter the headquarters put out for all stations. I started doing that in Spain. And I started getting some really, really negative feedback.
Hmm.
And you have to understand, I was not impressed at all with the way the observatory was working. It was
mm-hmm.
terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So little by little, I started forcing my procedures in. And so once I worked with this young man. I think he was a mathematician or physicist. He was a bachelor, American, who he was dropping me off after we worked together all night. And I asked him, anything on your mind? And I'm getting funny vibes. So he proceeded to rip into me. Well, good, I invited it and wanted it. About how I was treating everybody as if they were infants and on and on and on and on. Should have more respect for them. And there was probably a lot of truth in it. The people should have been treated differently, but they were also not doing the work very well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this was a surprise to me. I thought everybody at every state, every observatory would be exactly the same, but they mm-hmm. weren't. So I had to pull my horns in, sat down with all of them individually and as a group and talked things through. And we got things organized to both our what we wanted. I started treating them differently. They started producing the results I wanted. And I said, man, that was interesting.
That's great, yeah.
But again, another management kind of thing. And I'm really starting to love this management. Except when I had to do budgets. I mean, my whole life, budgets threw me into stress,
mm-hmm.
craziness. I just hated them. There were always more things I wanted to get done than money was available, and I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
So Spain went well. As a experience for Gene and me and the little guys, we just, on weekends, would travel around all over.
Mm-hmm.
During the bullfight season, spring to fall, each little town, there are all these little hilltop towns in
mm-hmm.
southern Spain,
mm-hmm.
and we're in Cadiz, the southernmost point of Spain, and it was not far from the Rota submarine base, the U.S. naval base, and we had PX, all kinds of privileges at Rota, and that in itself is a story, too. But on weekends, we'd get a car or rent a car and go to a little town. And on Sundays, there'd be a fair going on, and the town would be celebrating its patron saint day. So with the little kids in a stroller, we'd go through the fair. Late in the afternoon, it started at 4, there'd be the bullfight. We go to the bullfight. Here we had these two little blonde kids, pure white hair, with the Spaniards, southern Spain anyway, it's unusual. Mm. The Spaniards just loved them, and they were forever picking them up, and
aww.
Oh, wapo, wapo, oh, fair, blondie. We get to see the bullfight, and I started learning. And I learned one of my biggest management lessons at a bullfight. I mean, maybe my biggest. I had been to about a dozen bullfights. And then we were at this one, and we were with some Paco and some other Spanish friends. And by this time, I was doing fairly well in Spanish, and Gene was picking it up well. And I watched this bullfight, and there was a young matador, torero, and I thought he was impossibly good, the best. I mean, I'd never seen anything like this. And at the end, I think they awarded him 1 year on the bull, you know, instead of 2 years, a tail, and no one applauded very much. So I turned to the Spaniards mm-hmm. with me, and I said, mm-hmm. or maybe it was Paco, why
yeah.
wasn't everyone cheering? Why weren't women throwing things? And, you know, I mean, he looked at me and said, Oh, he hasn't been gored. I say he wasn't gored. I mean, he wasn't gored. That, he's so good. He said, no, no, no. He said, in Spain, we wait to see if the torero, once he gets severely gored, how he comes back and acts. He hasn't been gored yet, so we don't know how good he is yet.
Interesting.
I said, good Lord. And I think I've told this story.
That's
every
so
time
interesting.
In an organization I've been in,
yeah.
And we've been in a crisis, and someone is in a crisis and suffering and down.
Right.
I've done it with my three sons when they've had cry. I've done it with my grandchildren now.
That's a fantastic.
So we have this little language. I said,
where
the context is correct. And I say, you were gored a little bit here. So you were gored. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And my brain started really going towards. I'm a manager, and it was looking for all of these things of how you manage people. That's what management is. You can be brilliant in all kinds of technical stuff, but if you can't manage people, you're not going to be worth a damn. And and so you have to find out how they tick.
Interesting. And that's such an exercise in resiliency.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's so important.
And
wow, what a great story.
Yeah. So Spain was marvelous. My father and my Aunt Lucy came over for 3 or 4 weeks to visit. Unfortunately, it happened to be during the same time the associate director for science of the Smithsonian was visiting us. And I had invited all of the Americans, all of the Spaniards who worked for us. My father was living in the house. My father was overjoyed where we lived, because right around the corner was a wine shop.
I was waiting for that.
And all you had to do was bring your empty wine bottle over, and you get it refilled. I mean, he wore the pavement out. So I carefully said, you know, with Spaniards, I've got my boss way up there, the associate director right under Fred Whipple for science. Please, you know, be careful. Dress well for the Spaniards. I mean, everything is formal. It was then anyway with them. We're in the middle of a buffet. Jean had done this amazing buffet in our little. We were living in a cement a house called El Bidon, the can. Imagine a cement Quonset hut. And here in the large living room area, everybody's gathering and being social. And here my father wanders out with a bathing suit and a short top, introduces himself. I wanted to kill him. Goes up to Charles Lundquist, the assistant director for science, pulls him off to the side, and I'm thinking, oh, Lord. Turns out later he asked him, says, the conversation went something like, so Dr. Lundquist, how's my son doing? Is he doing a good job? You know, if he's not, you could let me know and I'll talk with him. And fortunately, Lundquist, I think, had a sense of humor or a sense of something. And I would have... I'm still speechless, but he had a good time.
That's
great. Time he was there.
That's great.
We had a very successful time in Spain. We loved it. We really learned a lot. Was there only a year, and Jean's father died, or was terminally ill, something. We went home at just for a visit. I'm home, and I get invited up to Cambridge. I mean, just some in the U.S., you know, let's see what's going on. And met with Ron LeCount, met with Jack Coffey, who had just replaced John Shaw. And another management thing. John Shaw, in his fervor to make us into a private sector kind of organization, had put in this GE program called Goals and Indicators, in which every year in the planning, but you had to define your goals, you had to define indicators, which were things which weren't quite goals, but which were important to your management. It all had to be very quantitative. You had to do this, and you were going to be measured every year. So I you know, we, and it, you know, it was a thick volume, and he hit John had put two people in charge of this, administering this program at headquarters and measuring and on and on and on. And I read this thing and I didn't understand it. I mean, it made no sense to me. Because our operation didn't, you couldn't do business like that. It was impossible.
Interesting.
So after a month of 2 months, maybe where I forced the staff to participate and they were always griping, and I finally had enough and I wrote this long memo back to headquarters saying why the whole idea was ill-conceived, why it couldn't work quantitatively, making suggestions. It was the longest memo I'd written to date. And I awaited my fate, figuring I'd be beheaded. Well, his whole program caused such a furor and uproar in the whole network.
Good, yeah.
That I turned out he had been fired, and Jack, who was now not personnel director, but he was a special chief staff assistant to the associate director for administration. He was working for the big guy who everyone reported to. Jack was running things, and it turned out he invited me up there and talked how's Spain going, told him. He said, I want you to come work at headquarters with me. I said, but I've only been in Spain a year, and I want to go to Hawaii the next thing. And he said, well, there's an opportunity. Up to you. So I said, oh, darn. Didn't say darn. So talked about it with Gene, and talked about it with Ron, who had been put over in another department to build a big telescope on Mount Hopkins in Arizona. And I said, okay. Jack had also invited the director of the South Africa station, a man named Sam Tischler, to come up and work with him. And once we both got there and settled in, we were told to divide all the stations up. I would run half, Sam would run half, and we'd be out in the field a lot more contact, and that's how we. So Sam and I remember one Saturday morning we went into the office and we had a blackboard, and we were, must have been like Hitler and Stalin dividing up Eastern Europe, you know? I mean, and we did, and he wanted that, and I wanted this, and we made these crazy configurations to satisfy our personal desires, but Jack Coffey went along with it. But what Jack was really doing, it turned out, Jack didn't want to stay director, he was acting, and he was finding someone who was a replacement for John Shaw, and it turned out to be me. And after a few months, he told me, but still didn't say don't say anything, because I want to keep doing this till we get to a certain. And then the whole net, within a year thereabout, the whole network was turned over to me. I was the manager.
Terrific.
And
you were in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Where did you live?
In Chelmsford, Mass., about just above Concord, about 30 miles north of Cambridge. Nice little suburb. We started living there, and I started, and now I said, now I really need management. So I enrolled in BU, Boston University's MBA program, and surely had my eyes open when I found out there really were, there were sciences, if I might call it that, of all of these things I didn't know and should know. And so I just went a couple of nights a week and studied all weekends and took my books with me when I was in Australia and everywhere, and managed to do well there, in spite of missing months at a time sometimes. And I would take Gina on the trips with me, too, whenever I could. She didn't get all of them, and she still is resentful about it. She missed some. But we had our third son in Cambridge, Stephen. So I have Harry, Robert, and Stephen. And in fact, one trip I had planned, which was Hawaii, Japan, Manila, for different reasons, Smithsonian had a science project going, Australia, and then coming back, we were going to stop in Tahiti for 4 or 5 days of vacation. And Jean said she wasn't missing that. Steve was about 1 month old. At this time, my family was living upstairs in my old house. Jean's mother, now a widow, was living, had taken the apartment downstairs, so all three kids just went there, and they had a newborn infant, and off we went. Jean wasn't missing that trip.
As you said, she liked adventure.
She's a wonderful traveler.
Wonderful.
And so we went along really, really nicely, doing all sorts of
how marvelous
good stuff. And I had lots of great experiences. One year when we were talking with NASA about the budget for the following year, NASA couldn't break the budget loose from OMB.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody at the Smithsonian, at the main headquarters in Washington, including Dylan Ripley, the secretary of the institution, got himself involved. Because here we are, you know, there's a bureaucratic reason for no longer NASA being able to give the funding to us. Jack Coffey sent me down to Washington to find out, because the Smithsonian had traced it to Defense Department holding it up. So I got with my NASA contract, a wonderful, wonderful man, and made an appointment. He made appointments with me, with DOD, the people who were holding it up, and I got down to go to the Pentagon, meet with this Admiral so-and-so, why we couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing conversation.
Hmm.
I mentioned early on some of the work we were doing was geodetic, getting measurements, geodetic programs worldwide, so we could measure a distance on any place on the Earth to another. We were up to, with our modified Schmidt telescope, where we could be accurate to within 10 meters. We had just upgraded to using laser instruments, where we could get the measurements down to a meter or less.
Wow.
DOD was alerted to this and said, no, can't do it. We're Smithsonian. We publish all our scientific results. We're not classifying. Their argument was, you got past us with the 10-meter thing, but we're not letting you go down another order of magnitude accuracy. And the reason was for the Russians aiming their ballistic missiles. And so I'm with this admiral, and I'm saying, are you telling me it's okay that they got it to within 10 meters, but if they get it to within 1 meter, that makes a difference? I said, this is insane. This is absurd. And so reported back through the hierarchy, and the Smithsonian having the facts were able to break it loose.
Wow.
But I had a great time walking around the Pentagon. There were so many generals and admirals. You couldn't walk 5 feet without it running into another one. It was the place was incredible. I'm sure it's worse now. But that was a fun kind of thing. I got to travel and see a lot of the world.
Wonderful.
Ran it and had huge negotiations in countries like Argentina, when they wouldn't renew our country-to-country agreement, and I was working with the Air Force. We were located on an Air Force something. And every day I'd go meet with them, and they wouldn't budge, nothing. Couldn't find out the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, had some Argentine friends from our site, and talking with them, and one of them said, he wants a bribe. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
So next time I met with him, I said, okay, the Secretary of the Smithsonian is going to come down to negotiate this with your Minister of Foreign Affairs, whom he reported to, which was not true. I mean, but all of a sudden it mysteriously
mm-hmm.
went through. And there were things like this that were eye-opening to me.
Mm-hmm.
Also stressful, but fun. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I just think the Smithsonian is the best thing going.
Okay.
So
I'll finish up with my astrophysical observatory at the Smithsonian. NASA, much to their detriment, starting finding ways to track satellites that were more efficient and better than the way we were doing it at the Smithsonian, mainly having electronic gear on the satellites, and the satellites were even tracking themselves and to ground automatically to ground-based stations. So our budget from NASA started getting cut drastically. I had to take our program down to less than half of what it was. I got tired of laying off people, and even though Susan wants to get to SDSU, just a few things. Again, through my friend Jack Coffey, he said that the Smithsonian headquarters in Washington had an opening that I might be interested in. And I went down and interviewed with the associates, the undersecretary, whatever it is, the chief scientific guy named Sid Galler. And he was looking for an assistant. I interviewed with him. He said he wanted to hire me. I went back to Cambridge, told everyone I resigned, had all the parties, went down to Washington, went to Dr. Galler's office. Oh, Harry, I've been meaning to get in touch with you. I said, what's up? He said, turns out you're not going to work for me. I said, oh, great. What, I left Cambridge. What am I doing? So you're going to work for Ames Wheeler. Ames Wheeler was, at that time, the treasurer of the Smithsonian.
Wow.
He had been brought in because the Smithsonian, private side of the Smithsonian, was going underwater, budget, cash-wise, because the institution was starting up the magazine, which was a tremendous cash drain. And not only the magazine, but the Smithsonian had something like 10 so-called revenue-producing activities. There was the magazine, there was the Smithsonian Press, a Belmont Conference Center in Maryland, all of the museum shops, all of the food concessions in the institution.
Mm-hmm.
What else? There's at least three or four more, which I can't remember. And during the budget discussions down in Smithsonian, Ames came in from Allegheny Ludlum, where he was a top executive in the steel industry, and he was brought into Washington to get Smithsonian's finances organized, to be blunt about it.
Yeah.
And he said, I saw Sid Galler had a position, and I stole it. And you had been told you're hired, and I see you've had some courses in MBA, and you know all of... I said, Ames, and I thought, you know, great, but I'll do my best. So I wound up with being responsible for all of the revenue-producing activities in Washington, none of which were in the black.
Mm.
So I had a three-year period, marvelous period, in which I had to learn the business of all of those activities, how they do business, why weren't they doing it well enough to make a profit when we got a captive audience of tens of millions of people a year. How do you, each one needed a different kind of accounting and reporting in order to be in effect. So I spent 3 years learning magazine business, the retail business, the press business, the you name it.
Wow.
And I was just flying. I mean, I was going to GW, George Washington University,
right,
at MBA at that time,
right,
too, and still learning what I was supposed to know. And we got most of them in the black.
That's fantastic.
Through a real effort. And so I know you want to get to SDSU, but after three, and I had some amazing offers when I was working with the private sector on a lot of these things. I started up a whole licensing program to make products that were replicas of things in the institution, which is now in the Smithsonian catalog, if you've ever said that.
Oh, I do get it.
Okay, I started all of that licensing program and all of that.
Wow.
And started negotiating for a television series with, at that time, the real biggies in the industry, David Walper and everything. And I learned how Hollywood does its business, which talk about constantly getting my eyes open. I won't say by whom, but I was given offers under the table, let's say, to contract somewhere, to do contracts. And while I was horrified, I found out it's the way of doing business in much of the private sector. And I was a virgin there.
Mm-hmm.
I always talk with Gene about it because I never did anything underhanded. I felt I worked for the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian was above that. The Smithsonian is this unique. I mean, an amazing place. But I always, Jean and I, when we talk about it, I always tell her, I have to admit, I don't know if because I was that honest or as if I was afraid of getting caught if I did, so I never resolved that one. But I have to say this, because it's germane to SDSU and when I came to the foundation.
Absolutely.
The Smithsonian is this amazing, wonderful combination of a private and a federal organization. It started out as a private organization.
Mm-hmm.
James Smithson, an amateur scientist, illegitimate son of an earl or something in England, who is best known, for, I think, for his work in geology. In fact, I have one of his minerals, a beautiful purple stone called Smithsonite. When he died, he left in his will all of his money would go to the United States to found at Washington, D.C., an institute for the increase and diffusion of knowledge among men. That was his only instruction. Congress, the president, got in a horrible scrabble about it, how to use it, as you can expect. I believe it was John Quincy Adams who finally got it all resolved and to set up a scientific organization, their main responsibility, astronomy. So that was the country's first scientific institution, all funded with Smithson's money.
Okay.
And so the Smithsonian, that's how it started. In the 1840s, maybe, 30s, I've forgotten that. I can't hold me to that. But what happened was Smithsonian started being doing really well as a scientific organization, and the country at the time in those 1800s was starting to accumulate all kinds of stuff to be preserved. And that's why the Smithsonian got the nickname the Nation's Attic. So all these treasures are coming to the government, and they didn't know what to do with it. Someone, I don't know who, had a bright idea. Let's, since we have a Smithsonian, it's a scientific organization, let's have them take care of everything, and we'll fund that museum aspect out of federal funds. So that's the Smithsonian, this ongoing private side and this amazing federal side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the private side is private. It's entrepreneurial. It isn't given money for free. You have to earn it in all your activities.
I see.
And so I became, you know, when I was there, I only worked on the private side. My main problem wasn't spending the money. My main problem was earning, bringing money in.
Yeah.
And just like SDSU, which has such a huge array of programs,
right,
grants and contracts, special programs, all things that are funded, not from state funds, but other funds,
right,
that's what the private side of the Smithsonian is. And that so I developed my expertise for working in a private environment in this case, a federal institution. But when I came to SDSU, I saw no difference between the foundation as the university's private entity and then the state side as the Smithsonian's federal entity. And that was my mindset when I came for my first interview. And fortuitously, the board, of the foundation and the selection committee I was dealing with were having ideas about how can the foundation, instead of being just recipient of funds that come in the door,
right,
but being entrepreneurial and really developing the foundation as something that could do more than it was doing in all aspects. And so I said, this is right up my alley, even though I didn't tell them. I guess I told them in the interview process, but it was always my agenda. It's the only real agenda I had, overriding agenda, all the time I was at San Diego State.
That's so fascinating how it just was the perfect fit.
Yeah. But let me just tell you how I got.
That's what there. How did that
happen? Yes, I did have a... at the end of my 3 years in Washington, Smithsonian was somewhat stodgy.
Mm-hmm.
All of the hierarchy, the main administrative people were Ivy League. My impression, I may be wrong on this, but most of them were belonged to the good old club, wealthy money, and all wore dark pinstripe suits to work. And
yeah.
I had a degree from Cornell, but I wasn't of that ilk. I wore sports jackets and had sideburns, and well, it didn't fit quite fit the mold. And I had a conversation with Ames once. I said, Ames, where do I go from here? Because I am an ambitious person. And he thought about it and said, well, you know, when I retire, I'd certainly put your name in to be treasurer. And I didn't want to see Ames retire for another 10 years, and that wasn't in my timetable. Mm-hmm. So what was going on at that time was my old friend Ron LeCount, he had left Astrophysical Observatory to be a program director in the National Science Foundation, in charge of all the National Astronomy Centers. And at Kitt Peak in Arizona, which is one of the National Centers for Optical Astronomy, and Cerro Tololo Observatory, which is affiliated, they work together as the nation's optical observatories, were looking for director administration. And Ron told me, and kept twisting my arm, because they reported to him, he was not very happy with how things were being done administratively out there. I kept saying, apply for this position, apply for this position. And it turned out the fairly new director of Kitt Peak was a man named Leo Goldberg, who had been the department chair of astronomy at Harvard when I was up at SAO, who I met at some cocktail parties but never had a relationship. So I finally wrote a letter to Leo saying, Ron asked me to do this, and here's my resume, and sounds like an interesting position. If you're interested, let me know. Leo got on me almost instantly. He says, I do remember you from Smithsonian, and come on out and interview. So I went out and interviewed at Kitt Peak, and also with the Cerro Tololo director, Victor Blanco, and the job sounded fantastic. But here I was going back to my astrophysical observatory days, forgetting about all my fun at the Washington, and it was a terrible decision. Ames Wheeler, my boss, happened to be on a Caribbean vacation, and I told Leo Goldberg, I want to come work for you, but I don't want to I want to be able to talk to Ames first when he comes back, so I don't want the news to get out. And Leo said, fine. And Ames was going to be gone for 3 more weeks yet. Well, in that 3 weeks, it turned out Leo and Dylan Ripley, the head of the Smithsonian, both members of the National Academy of Sciences, and rubbed elbows at one of their cocktail parties. And I remember Leo telling me, he said, hey, Dylan, how do you feel about me stealing one of your men?
Oh, there you go.
And Ripley said, who are you stealing? And Harry, and no one knew anything. So I got back the next day, and I got summoned to Mr. Ripley's office, which was not a usual state of events. And I got a modest dressing down, but the news was out. Ames said it was fine, and he just died a couple of years ago. Have always stayed in contact. He was a wonderful, he was a mentor. He taught me so much that was applicable for SDSU. For instance, Ames was in charge of all the Smithsonian's investments, private investments, tens of millions, 100 million. And so I worked for him on all the investments.
Yeah.
I learned investments.
Yeah.
I was taking investment courses at GW. So all these skills that I learned when I was there, it was almost like someone had led me through a series of things. So when I hit SDSU, I had a nice set of skills that could be used here, exploited here.
What a wonderful preparation.
Yeah. So off we moved to Tucson. And loved Tucson. We had never lived in the West. Got a house up in the foothills, Catalina foothills. When I was out there interviewing, I think that was the selling point. The president of the university consortium that ran the observatories invited me to his home up in the foothills, and here's downtown Tucson. And oh my God! And it was winter time, and it was beautiful. I loved it. And Gene said, "We're taking this job," and so we did. But it was great. I was back in working in a real scientific environment, head of administration for Kitt Peak, and also I was able to hire the chief administrator who reported to me at Cerro Tololo in Chile. He used to work for me in Spain at the Astrophysical Observatory, totally fluent in Spanish. And we, through Leo and him giving me the chance, and a newly hired director of engineering at Kitt Peak about my age, we reorganized all of those observatories. We acquired, and NSF asked us, the New Mexico Solar Observatory. It became part of our center, so we were doing three national centers. I got involved in planning for the Hubble Space Telescope, which Aura won that contract to run the Hubble. And so it was great. And it was, again, to me, I was ready to stay in Tucson the rest of my life. I love the place. I love the job so much. It was so frequent trips to Chile. And just being in that environment and being able to talk to the astronomers and whatever. And at the end of 4 years, Leo announced he was going to be retiring in a few years. And I said, oh, gosh. You know, I found in my career, without fail, when there's a change in administration, above, you know, someone I'm going to report to, I haven't done too well. Through my own personality quirks and whatever, I'm sure. But my deal was always with the person I worked for, and we would talk about it explicitly when they hired me. I said, we will come to agreement on how you want me to do the job. Once we do, you leave me alone and support me.
That's great.
If I do well, you reward me. If I don't, you fire me. I mean, simple as that. And I've had all of my successful relationships have been like that with whoever I worked for. I mean, so.
Very interesting.
So that's, and from Kitt Peak, when Leo said he was going to retire, we had a board of directors for that Association of University, which ran our national centers. That was amazing. It was two people from every university. It was typically the chair of the astronomy department and the VP for administration of the university, each university. And it, when I joined, it was like 12 universities. It was Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Michigan, Indiana, Caltech, Texas. Who else? I can't remember the others, but so I was working whenever we had three or four board meetings a year, and I would put on all of the administrative stuff in front of all the VPs of these major universities, and so I got to know them. One of the people, an at-large director, was a gentleman named Bill Golden, who was another one of these people who, like Jack Coffey and Ron LeCount and Ames Wheeler in Washington, were a mentor and a something for me in the police force. They say you only get ahead if you have a rabbi, I think that is the mystery novel's name. Some of my rabbis. And Bill was an older gentleman. He, in fact, was one of Harry Truman's advisors. And, in fact, was one of the men behind when World War II ended, was a driving force in setting up the National Science Foundation. World War II, everyone in Washington discovered that the huge research breakthroughs that were winning the war were done at universities. Not all of them, but a huge number. So they said, we got to keep this good thing going. And to do it, we want to set up the National Science Foundation as a pure funding agency to fund universities to engage in frontier research things. That's what the NSF is. Bill was a founding father of that. He was on our Aura board. He, at the time, he was also his chairman, lived in New York City, operated on Wall Street, very wealthy. He was also on the board of all kinds of organizations in New York City, one of them being Barnard College.
Ah, here we go. Okay.
And so Bill put his arm around my shoulders one day and said, Harry, we had become good friends. Said, Harry, you know what? I am chairing the search committee for a president and a vice president for finance at Barnard College. And we're hiring both. My committee is hiring both people, and I'd like you to apply. I said, Bill, the last place I want in the world I want to work is New York City. I hate New York City. It's just across the river from me. I never liked it. And I said, I don't want to live there. I'm living in Tucson. God, that I found myself. He said, well, are you going to be around New York? And it turned out I was going back to Lake Patcong for a vacation that summer. So he said, come on over. I said, mm-hmm. okay, and just talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
I did. They made me a nice offer. And I thought the writing was on the wall in Kitt Peak with the names of people being bruited about who might succeed Leo Goldberg.
I see.
Were not to my liking.
Okay, so that...
I have well-developed antenna, whether they serve me well or not. Mm-hmm. When I see something in the future, I get out.
Yeah.
So I said, I will do this. I will do it. I said, I've worked with all these VPs from around the country. I can be a VP at Barnard and so affiliated with Columbia.
Right.
If I work there 2 or 3 years, I can parlay it into a vice presidency somewhere I want to be, not New York City.
Yeah.
So I accepted it. And at the same time, they're hiring a woman from Brown to be president. And we never met during the interview process, which was probably a mistake. So I accepted the job. Never put my heart and soul into it because I set up the family at Lake Patcong.
I was wondering about that.
And commuted 50 miles a day.
Bring everybody into New York. And
yeah.
I mean, I'm very well aware of the... You're talking now in the 70s, right? Are you?
Yeah, I left Kitt Peak in 76.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I lived in New York City. I remember well what it's like to rent. Yeah. And with children and school.
Right.
Oh, my.
So... the long and short of the matter is I was given the specific charge by the board to come up with a financial plan to get Barnard. Barnard was in terrible shape. It was so run down.
Hmm.
It was eating up its endowment. I was given my specific task was you run that administrative side and you bring to the board a plan
mm-hmm.
to get Barnard on its feet. We don't care what's in your plan. You get a good plan. So I put one of these big planning things together that universities like to do with students, staff, faculty, community,
mm-hmm.
board members. Yeah, horrible. and we came up with one hell of a plan. All the while, I had kept the president informed, mm-hmm. sent her the drafts as each of the committee, this huge committee, always got notes back, great job, looks good, praising. Finally, I had to present it to the board, and we were meeting in the home on Central Park West, you know, elevator right to your floor,
mm-hmm.
The chairman's home, and it was the finance committee of the board that had given me my charge, myself and the president.
Yeah.
And I went through the plan, and they were with me. They were excited. I mean, and I had bounced it off some of them to... Mm-hmm. So I knew it was all choreographed. They started asking really hard questions, which I had answers to, and which were things the board was going to have to decide on, and they were willing to. And finally, if we're all done, I had an hour, sigh of relief. The chairman turned to the president and said, "Well, how do you feel? How do you feel about this?" Because the president had said. And the president said, I quote, "That's all Harry's plan. I had nothing to do with it." The exact words.
Oh, my.
And the president had panicked for some reason. And
wow.
Everybody thought it was a joke. We all laughed. And then it was serious. So that left the meeting in shambles. Off I went. I told people on the board I couldn't work there any longer. They told me I couldn't work there any longer also now. And so they said, this was in October, November. They said, okay, you can retain your title if it helps you finding another job, but you better just not come in. And we'll pay you through for June, I think it was. And then my friend Bill Golden privately said, "Harry, if you haven't found anything by June and Barnard doesn't give you any more, I'll do it. Just find the job you want."
Uh-huh.
So I spent responsibility-free winter at Lake Apakong with my family, except
it was stressful
in that I didn't have a position.
And I would imagine, I mean, just to have her do that would be so disturbing.
Well, it was, and I'm a person who, when there is stress, I react accordingly and get rid of it, try to get rid of it somehow, proactively get rid of it, and I can't settle down until I do. But this gets us nicely to SDSU, because it was around February of 78, so I had been 3 months, 4 months looking for a job, and I had wonderful, I was taking interviews at places I wanted to live. There was one at the University of New Hampshire, vice president, one at the chief of administration at the National Center in Boulder, Colorado, the vice presidency of the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii. I think they were the three that I really liked. Didn't land any of them, unfortunately.